This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to this week's excerpt from the Dear Prudence podcast. To get the full-length members-only version every week, join Slate Plus at slate.com/prudypod.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudy, do you think that I should contact him again?
Help.
Help. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Dear Prudence podcast once again, and as always, I am your host, Mallory Ortberg, also known as Dear Prudence. With us in the studio today is a fellow Slate podcaster, Gabriel Roth, and I'm really looking forward to throwing him into the mix shortly. But first, I have an important update for all of you out there, and also a request for those of you who have the knowledge and the desire to share some opinions with us, which is that my producer, Audrey, just told me as I walked into the studio today that she has just started watching Star Trek. I needed a minute. I had to sit down. This is very important to me. My favorite thing in the world is when people just start watching Star Trek. By the way, if you don't like Star Trek, that's fine. You don't have to. I would never want to push Star Trek on someone who did not want to love it. But if you do want to love it, you will. I can tell you right now that becoming someone who loves Star Trek it requires only willingness, or even the willingness to become willing. And I think she's already there. She's starting with TNG, and immediately, Jim, the sound engineer, and I just started screaming at her movies that she needs to start watching immediately and movies she needs to pretend never existed. So right now, I think we've got her on TNG, then Voyager, then the original series, because she gave it a try, and she's not yet ready to accept Jim Kirk as her personal Lord and Savior, which is fine. She'll get there. I understand it. I have absolute faith in her innate goodness. She's not allowed to watch Generations. She is allowed to watch First Contact. I feel like those are pretty basic steps, which is not to say, by the way, no one can ever watch Generations. I'll never watch it again for as long as I live. But you can. You need to be prepared for it. There's things you need to have settled in your own heart of hearts before you're ready to go through the process of experiencing Generations. And I would never want to inflict that on somebody who hadn't trained for years. So Audrey, who has already thrown her hat across the room in exasperation, you know not what you have signed up for. That seems like a great place to introduce our guest. Gabriel Roth is the host of Mom and Dad Are Fighting, a parenting podcast from Slate. He's also a senior editor at Slate and the editorial director for Slate Plus. Gabriel, welcome.
Hey, thank you. Glad to be here.
Have you ever seen Star Trek Generations?
I don't think I've seen Star Trek Generations, no.
Okay. Well, that is something you do not need to add to the list of things you need to do. Continue living your life without having seen it.
I'm glad to know I've been doing that right the whole time.
Is there anything that you would add to the list that we have already given Audrey?
You know, my Star Trek foo isn't really deep enough to challenge yours, so I'm sure Audrey's doing it just fine.
Well, that's a very diplomatic and kind answer, and I just, again, want to make it really clear. As much or as little Star Trek as a person wants to have in their life is a beautiful thing. If you only love Star Trek a little, love it a little. That's great. I'm very happy for you. I would never want anyone to feel like they needed to love it more just because it's the only thing I care about.
I think the only Star Trek I remember is there was a movie with whales. They went to San Francisco and there were whales.
The only Star Trek movie you've seen is The Journey Home?
Can I just wind back the tape to a minute ago where you said as much or as little Star
no,
Trek
no,
as
no,
a
no, no. I'm so sorry. The like incredulity in my voice is not one of like you ridiculous person. It's just that's like I don't know how that happens. I don't know how you get to Star Trek IV all on its own. I mean, it's amazing. I love the one with whales. It's beautiful. You get Spock mind melding with whales. You get that great scene on the bus. It's a fantastic movie. I want to know.
Nine, and there was a movie of Star Trek, and there were whales. It's all coming back to me. I mean, it's all coming back to me like three words: Star Trek and whales.
Yeah, no, yeah.
No more than that is coming back to me.
You are remembering it correctly. There are whales in it, and you know what? You got it. You got the full Star Trek experience. It's pretty much a show about whales. It's basically that SeaWorld documentary.
I'm a Trekker now.
Oh, my gosh. Well, now that we've gotten all of that settled, I would love to apologize in advance for giving you a lot of questions about really thorny, difficult parenting issues, but also not really apologize because I still want you to help me answer them.
Love parenting issues. Love
what them. Do you have any general advice for listeners out there who might parent or be adjacent to parenting at some point in their life before we
jump
in?
Yeah, I mean, it turns out that many of us have some relationship to parenting, that even if you think you've never parented, you may well have been parented. And you can look to that experience of having been parented as a sort of guideline for what works and what doesn't work. What did you like about being parented? And maybe more importantly, what did you very, very strongly dislike? And it's always good to react really strongly and extremely against the things that your parents did that you didn't like, and just go all the way over to the other end of the spectrum, because that way you're sure not to make any mistakes.
That sounds pretty solid. So you have, from the senior editor at Slate, a guarantee that you will not make mistakes as a parent if you listen to the rest of the show, which I think is a pretty solid endorsement. And on that note, I think we should just dive right in.
Let's do it.
As Spock dived in with the whales in the voyage home. I'm so sorry I said that.
I love that you said that.
It happened. Would you read our first letter while I, deal with my shame?
Absolutely. The subject line on this letter is, how do I protect my kids from my narcissistic husband? Hi, Prudy. I started therapy several months ago after a bout of depression and anxiety. After some digging, I realized a lot of my issues were tied to my husband and his possibly undiagnosed personality disorder. Though my therapist and I cannot diagnose him, we are both fairly certain that he is a textbook narcissist. For me, this felt like a weight was lifted. The criticism, the demands to be perfect and to never make mistakes, being treated like I am beneath him and stupid, all while spending day in and day out listening to him obsess over other people's money and success, schemes to get rich, etc. The problem is, we have two small children that he is equally hard on. There are plenty of good times, but good times don't put people in therapy. The older they get, the more he yells, screams, throws tantrums when they make simple mistakes that all children make. We walk on eggshells to please him, which is a losing game. My fear is that if I leave him, he will be alone with them for visitation, and that is a bad idea. But if I stay, they are exposed to him more often. I feel stuck and have no idea what to do.
Man, so this is obviously a heavy one. So I just want to start by pointing out something I loved about this letter, which is that there's so clearly a line in here that the letter writer got from her therapist, which is, there are good times, but I know good times don't put people in therapy. And I don't know, I found that really charming. Like, that's wonderful that you got there. And I love that you threw that little nugget from your therapist in here. Thank you for doing that.
Mm. Also, I like the caveat that although my therapist and I cannot diagnose him, we are both fairly certain that he is a textbook narcissist. Everybody is trying really hard to get that right these days, now that we're all starting to diagnose people's personality disorders long distance.
Yes. And I do think that that's worthwhile, because I have noticed that as well. It is a trend now in letters, whereas I think people used to just say, I believe this person has such and such personality disorder. Now they will say, I know I can't make this diagnostic myself. And then they will say it anyways.
Right, exactly. And what they're really saying is, this guy is a fucking narcissistic asshole. This guy is an extreme personality. And like, that is a thing that you can say as a person who observes him by virtue of being married to him.
Right. And I think sometimes the reason that people will feel like there's a need to have a term for it is because they feel like otherwise it's not enough on its own.
That's right.
He may very well have a particular personality disorder. He also may not. You don't need to worry about that. You've got enough with he's always criticizing me, demands that I'm perfect, yells at me, and treats me like I'm stupid. That's enough right there to
That's exactly right. Your problem is you're married to a narcissistic asshole.
Yeah, exactly. Whether or not there's a formal diagnosis for it, don't worry about it. He's a jerk. He's being a jerk to you. You don't need to worry about that. But these are both really minor points. I do want to get to the sort of main question here, which I feel like is, you know, is it okay for me to leave? Like, am I allowed to leave? And won't it be worse if he gets visitation by himself? Am I not, in fact, doing more good by staying and cushioning some of the blows? Which I feel like you and I are probably going to have the same answer to.
I think we are. And I think that answer is going to be like, nah, get out of there.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't think that it's actually better for your kids to live with your husband full time and to see him yelling at you and at them constantly.
And to see you throw your body in between him and them and then wake up the next day and do it over and over again.
Right. Yeah. I also think, you know, filing for divorce, you can also petition for supervised visitation. I mean, these are issues that you can raise in your custody agreement, which are, you know, my husband screams at our kids. And that's not to say that you will be automatically granted sole custody and you'll be able to control the way that he acts around your children. But that's absolutely, you know, push for maximal custody, whatever that looks like. I think that that would be good for you and your children.
That's exactly right. Talk to a divorce lawyer. A divorce lawyer can tell you, like, if you begin documenting your husband's behavior, write down in as neutral a way as you can the things that he says and does at particular dates and times. And then after you've collected some information, take it to a divorce lawyer and say, I think it's harmful for this guy to be around my children. I think when we divorce, he should not get unsupervised visitation rights. Do you think that's achievable? And from the description, it seems to me like it should be, but a divorce lawyer can give you a more informed answer.
Right. And, you know, even if, you know, unfortunately, like being a jerk of a parent does not necessarily mean anything when it comes to custody agreements. It is not illegal to be a jerk to your kid. But if nothing else, for your kids to see from you a really clear denunciation of the way that he treats you and them. And for you to say, this is not okay. This is not how I want to be treated by a partner. This is not how I want my kids to be treated on a daily basis. To see you create a different kind of home where they will hopefully be able to spend more of their time and to see the difference. Like, they're always going to grow up with this guy as their dad. And unless he makes some serious changes, they're always going to see that side of him. But they will, at the very least, the one thing you can control is what they see from you. And, like, if they are able to spend more of their time with you and see how he is and then see how you are and the difference between those two, I think that would be really good for your children to say, like, I don't want that in my life. I don't want to end up like that. I don't want to be partnered with people like that. I want to make the kind of choices that I see my mother modeling. And I think that that would be incredibly good for your kids.
I agree with that 100%.
If nothing else, yeah, to get a break so that it's not 24/7 of when is dad going to lose it again? Yeah. No, and I mean, I appreciate your pointing out that it's not all a nightmare, but I just also want to say, letter writer, you do not mention any good times in your letter. There's nothing in your letter that sounds good to me, especially when it's something that's unpredictable. You never know when it's going to switch from everything's great, we've got fun dad, to you're all holding me back, dragging me down, you're all the worst. I could have done all these things if I weren't tied to any of you, and you're all like terrible people. That's awful to never know when the next like axe is going to fall.
Yep. And this is the way with, of course, you know, we can't diagnose anybody without having met them or seen them.
Or having some sort of medical or psychiatric degree.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. There's all kinds of reasons why we can't diagnose anybody. But one thing about narcissistic personalities is that when you are like within the circle of their affection, that can feel very good. Right.
Yeah.
When you get to bask in their reflected self-love, then narcissists can be very appealing people. But when you know that that can turn on and off on a dime, depending on whether you are like the good part of me or the bad part of me that I have to expel or whatever,
right.
That is not a healthy identity for a kid to grow up with.
Yep. Yep.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This next one is going to be a nice palate cleanser in between some serious family things, but I love this because I don't get enough questions about tipping. And this question is all about tipping. And if there's one thing I've learned from being on the internet is that there is no shortage of opinions about tipping. And I'm excited to wade into the debate.
Let's go.
Subject of this is just bad tipper, question mark. Dear Prudence, I live on a tight budget, but decided to treat myself to a massage for my birthday. A local massage therapist was offering half-price massages through Groupon, and I decided to try it. After purchasing the massage, I was directed to her website, which was the only way to book with her, and discovered there was an additional $15 booking fee. Somehow, I was charged twice for the booking fee, so my half-price massage ended up being full price. When I emailed the therapist about the extra charge, she responded that I needed to read the fine print and didn't believe that I was charged twice, parentheses, I was. And that was that. I thought this was rather rude, but I'd already paid for the massage at that point, and I was determined to keep the appointment, even though I was pretty sure she had lost my future business. I also determined that the extra money I was charged would serve as her tip, and so did not give her an additional tip the day of the massage. Was I wrong? Was I being too sensitive?
This sounds like a really fun massage. Super
relaxing.
Can you
imagine? Can you imagine going in mad at your massage therapist?
If there is one thing that makes a massage more relaxing and enjoyable, it's bitter monetary resentment.
Hating the person who is touching your body.
Feeling like super ripped off by this massage therapist.
And just like, I can't wait till I get to stiff them on the tip.
Yep. This is, I mean, that's just going to be a great massage.
This sounded awful. I'm sorry for the both of you. I cannot imagine either being massaged by a person I was mad at or massaging someone that I was mad at. Those both sound terrible.
Oh, and it's your birthday.
Oh, and it's your birthday. I'm really sorry, letter writer. I don't mean to laugh at your misfortune, but this really sounds like a bummer and a half all the way around.
So tipping.
Sure. I mean, I don't believe I have ever been so upset with a service provider that I didn't tip as like a show of my feelings. But that is an option people have in the world. Like, it is something you can do if it feels really important to you to express displeasure with the service. Like, it's not illegal. You're not going to be shunned from society. It should probably be something that you reserve for pretty serious situations. But you can do it. You're allowed.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a line here where, like, let's say you get a massage and the massage is just not a very good massage and the massage therapist doesn't seem to be like really giving it their all or whatever.
Sure.
And you're disgruntled and you think maybe you want to stiff them on the tip. I don't think you should. Maybe you shouldn't tip with your usual generosity or whatever. But like, I think the tip is part of the fee for the service in that case. Like, for waiters, for massage therapists, for taxi drivers, like, the tipping is part of how they earn their living. And like,
right.
Don't be an asshole.
And it should be a real last resort, right? Like,
right.
If you're in the middle of the massage. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I guess I'm saying there's a line between like poor service, like a bad massage, and then the massage therapist has actually ripped you off.
Ah,
like,
okay.
If we stipulate that this person did get charged twice, like they got charged the service fee two times, and they pointed that out and gave the massage therapist a chance to redress the problem, and the massage therapist said, no, you weren't charged twice. If we stipulate that that sequence of events happened, then I think it's fair to say, you know what? I've already tipped you. You've already
Sure.
gotten your tip. Enjoy, and thank you for the massage.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's distinct from getting a massage and thinking, this is not exactly what I wanted, where probably a better thing would be to say, can you focus on this area, or can you use more pressure, or try to redress it in the moment rather than wait until the end to like hand some sort of punishment out as you're on the way out the door?
Yeah. And in the end, when you get a bad massage, you don't go back to that massage person, and that's the cost of doing business. But when somebody actually, like, rips you off and won't fix it, then, yeah, fine. There's a sort of rough justice to then refusing to tip that person.
Would you have gone and gotten this massage if you were at the point where you had said, I was charged twice, here you can see on the receipt, and they just said, nope, doesn't look like anything to me, like they were Bernard from Westworld. Spoilers for Westworld, everyone.
It's a great question. I haven't seen Westworld. Are there any whales in Westworld?
At some point, someone doesn't see a door. It's not really a spoiler if you don't know anything else. But if you're partway through the season, I've just ruined everything for you.
Sounds super spooky. I think it's a tough one about would you get the massage because, as the letter writer says, I've already paid for the massage, right? So you can either feel ripped off and not get a massage, or you can feel ripped off and get a massage from someone that you're mad at. And neither of those seems like a great way to spend your birthday. In a way, like, the lesson here is Groupon sucks because nobody who offers a Groupon can make money out of doing Groupon. So there's always some kind of hustle involved.
Right. And, so they're already kind of upset that they feel they have to use Groupon to get business.
Yeah. And they're looking for ways to cut corners and not lose their shirt on providing a service for you. And you are trying to get a deal, but you're going to wind up also getting some bad feeling around it, 30% of the time or whatever it is.
Right. I guess now Groupon will never be offering to sponsor this podcast. That's
Sorry,
fine.
Groupon.
They haven't tried to sponsor it before, so I don't feel like I've done anything wrong by joining you in complaining about that service.
And I've never done Groupon, and it may be a wonderful thing, but you hear about this kind of thing happening a lot, and you hear that restaurants and service providers fucking hate it. And the letter writer says, I'm on a tight budget, and I decided to treat myself to a birthday massage, and so maybe this was the only way that person could get a massage on their birthday, but, like, tough one, really tough.
Right. Well, and this is where, and I feel like maybe this is more of where my thoughts have landed because, this was about getting kind of taken advantage of financially, and I can understand why you felt like you'd already offered the tip. But part of what's difficult is there's sort of two competing forces at play, one of which is you should not have to be an incredibly wealthy person to be able to occasionally get a massage. Like, it's really a good thing to be able to do for your body. We do a lot to our bodies throughout the day, and it's pretty exhausting, and it can be really, really helpful for like just pain and discomfort to get an occasional massage, and you should not have to fork out, hundreds of dollars to get that. And then on the other hand, massage is both intimate and highly skilled. So it's difficult to try to look for discounts and bargains in a way that it would not be for purchasing like a shoe. Even if it was like a used shoe, you can still get a really great used shoe for way less than new shoes. But discount massages, often like in either direction of price, either the person who's providing this skilled service or the person who's trying to get some relief for pain and stress, somebody's getting stiffed in a way that's really tough to figure out how to navigate.
Yeah.
So I think the government should subsidize massages.
Well, I do agree with that, like that it should be included in a comprehensive national insurance program, should include sort of soft medical care like massage therapy. This is a complete tangent, but there's a line from the autobiography of Agatha Christie, which you've probably read. But
Nicole has read me all of the relevant parts very loudly over the phone.
All right. Well, there's a line where she looks back on her childhood and says, when I was a kid, I never imagined that we would be rich enough to have an automobile or poor enough not to have servants.
Hmm.
And it blows your mind until you realize that, like, physical goods get cheaper and personal services get more expensive.
Yep.
And so now everyone can have a car and only really rich people get to have servants. But so things like massages become more and more and more expensive. And that sucks because massages are great and we need them. And as you say, the government should fund them.
Well, we got way off track, but at least we were able to reassure this letter writer that at least in their particular instance, they had already paid this person a tip. And for the rest of us, you should probably tip people unless they have run over your dog, in which case, feel free to stiff them.
Literally tip, except when the person has stolen money from you already, which case don't tip and then feel vindicated.
Yeah. No, it's built in often to how much people are paid and you should be tipping on a really, really regular basis. All right. Let's take the next one, which is, man, so many moms today. Moms and stepmoms running all over the place, bringing up thorny issues. The subject line of this one is intruding at a funeral. Dear Prudence, I just found out that my high school boyfriend's mother died. I haven't seen her in about 2 decades, but during the almost 4 years that I dated her son, she was like a second mom to me, especially when my own wasn't available to actively parent. I loved her a lot. I'm no longer in contact with any of their family, and I haven't seen or heard from any of them since the early 2000s. Is it weird or intrusive to show up at a funeral for someone you haven't seen in years? I'm not always really socially confident, and I don't want to make anyone, especially my ex and his wife, uncomfortable. This is what's so complicated about funerals, because there are no invitations. Weddings, you get invited or you're not invited, and you know either you're going to be asked to go or not. And funerals, no one sends out invitations. So there's just this general sense of, am I allowed?
Yeah, that's right. I think there's a principle that applies to funerals, which is the more the merrier. Like, although merrier isn't quite what you're going for with a funeral, but like a good funeral is packed, right? A good funeral has like bums on seats.
Yeah,
and that's what we want from our nearest and dearest's funerals.
Unless, you know, with the caveat, if there is someone who, if they saw you, would run screaming.
Yeah, that's bad.
In which case, you know, reconsider.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you know, absolutely. Like, no, you're not in close contact with them. You wouldn't necessarily be going over for lunch, but she was a really meaningful part of your life. You remembered her really fondly. You don't, you know... You and your high school boyfriend presumably have both moved on. Like, he's married. It's not like you guys dated just a few years ago and it ended really badly. Like, I don't think it would be painful for his wife to see his high school girlfriend. I think you should go. And if it would make you feel better, if you have contact information for this ex, you know, to send like a note or a message somehow, just saying, I'm so sorry about your mom's loss the loss of your mom, and to just say one or two things that she really, about how she meant a lot to you, just so they're kind of aware that you remember her really fondly and that you're thinking of her. But yeah, absolutely go.
The other thing you can do in the note is you can say, like, I would love to go to the funeral if it's not just for close friends and family. And you can sort of give him an opportunity to, like, warn you off if he really doesn't want to see you.
Right. But presumably, I mean, I assume they're asking this question because they know where the service is going to be held.
Yeah, that's true.
Because otherwise, I feel like they would ask. So, you know, if the information about where and when the service is going to be has been made public, you know, implicit in that is you can come even if you're not in close regular contact with us. If you have something you shared with this woman and you want to remember her with us, please come.
That's true. But if she's worried that the ex-boyfriend, the high school boyfriend, is going to feel upset at her being there, she can give him the opportunity to make a sort of white lie. To warn her off and say, well, it's really only for the family, even if that isn't true, and they both know it isn't true. It's a way of sort of signaling, actually, I'd be happier if you didn't come. But as you said, I think that seems really unlikely to me. What you want at a funeral is people from all throughout the span of the dead person's life, right?
Right, not just the people you yourself know. You want to see, like, wonderful surprises of, I did not even know that my, like, loved one touched all these people's lives in all these different ways.
Like, the son's high school girlfriend, that's like a perfect person to see at a funeral. The person who you haven't seen in 20 years, but your mom still meant a lot to them and your mom is still in her heart. You want all those people there. When I die, I want my children's high school boyfriends and girlfriends to be there, like, quietly weeping for me and for their lost youth or whatever.
Oh my gosh. I want your high school boyfriends and girlfriends at my funeral thinking about what a great person I was, even though we haven't met and are in no way connected. That's what I want.
Now I feel like I will go to my grave unhappy if I don't think that my children's high school partners are going to be at my funeral. It just seems, I'm more and more talking myself into, like, no, you should fucking go with a t-shirt saying high school girlfriend.
Live your life in such a way that if you have children and they date in high school, those people 20, 30 years from now will be showing up at your funeral, even though they haven't talked to your stupid kid in 20 years.
That's exactly right.
Because they remember you more fondly than their high school boyfriend or girlfriend.
Totally. And the boyfriend will love to hear her say, like the letter writer says in the letter, there's a nice detail where she says, like, I'm not always really socially confident.
Hmm.
And so presumably there's some amount of anxiety in her around going to this funeral because yeah. will she know the right thing to say? And the other awesome thing about funerals is you always know the right thing to say because the right thing to say is always, God, I'm so sorry about your mother.
And literally any nice thing you remember about their mother.
That's right. If she wants to get into a nostalgic conversation with him, she can say, you know, your mother was so kind to me and she made a big difference to me at a time when I really needed someone to help me out in the way that she did. And if he wants to pursue it, he can pursue it and she can follow his lead.
Yeah.
I'm so excited for her to go to this funeral now.
I am too. Yeah. So send the note. And then, you know, it may be that you won't hear anything back in part just because he's probably really busy planning his mom's memorial service. But unless you hear, please don't come. It's for close friends and family only. You have implicit permission to attend.
If she doesn't attend, then frankly, I don't know what she should. If she doesn't attend.
I think you should go. I think you should go unless you are told not to. I think that is generally the rule with funerals. So
go to the funeral. Always go.
Yep. All right. Next one. Why don't you take us away on that one?
Sure. This one has the subject line, unwilling homophobe. I grew up in a very Christian, conservative environment and was taught that homosexuality was wrong. I believed this until I went to a liberal school and met openly gay people for the first time and realized that, nope, people are people. I became good friends with a gay woman who I'll call Abigail, and when we both got jobs in the same city after graduating, we became roommates. I lecture my family about being stuck in the Stone Age when they express disapproval of my living with her. Then Abigail found a girlfriend, Betty. Abigail and Betty became inseparable overnight. Betty is over almost every evening and weekend, and they are always, always touching. I'm really glad for Abigail since she's happy after being single for a long time, and I don't even mind that I have an unofficial third roommate. The problem is me. I have a completely unwilling, involuntary, internal ick reaction when I see them together. I have the same reaction when I see other same-sex couples around town. I'm ashamed to feel this way, and of course I hide it. I still have this reaction, despite living with Abigail and Betty for almost a year. I feel like a hypocrite, and I'm terrified that I'll slip up and Abigail will see my hidden disgust, which would, of course, really, really hurt her. And no, I'm not a self-closeted lesbian with buried feelings for Abigail. I'm trying but failing to unbrainwash myself. What do I do? How do I make this stop?
Man, this one, I gotta say, I feel so much tenderness and pride for this letter writer in a way that I don't know that I was expecting.
Say more about the pride.
I will. You know, we will occasionally get letters from somebody who is trying to figure out how they are going to relate to queer people because they come from a background where they have been taught that it's some sort of compromise of one's moral values. And they sort of want to be nice, but they also disapprove. And there's this sort of question of, you know, how much do I really let my true feelings show? And those questions are fine to ask. And, you know, there's certain rules of politeness and privacy that govern social interactions. And I'm happy to sort of give them generic advice and let them like go on their way without kind of going after hearts and minds. But this one feels really different from that. And I think one of the things that I admire so much about this letter writer is it's really easy to act in a way that we feel strongly about. And it's really difficult to act, especially in a daily, intimate way, against really strong, ingrained feelings. So the fact that you are aware that your internal reaction to either seeing Abigail and Betty together or other like same-gender couples, that you get that that is not an accurate reflection of your values, that that's a leftover from the ways in which you were raised, and that you are actively fighting against that on a daily basis. That's really difficult to do. And I think that demonstrates a lot of integrity and a lot of character, and a really strong sense of who's the person I want to be, not just who is the person it's easiest for me to be. And so I hope you can give yourself credit for the work that you are already doing. I do also want to answer your question because I believe that you do need help continuing down this path. But just like give yourself a lot of credit for taking yourself pretty far down a great path already.
Yeah, I totally agree. And yes, second to that, kudos to the letter writer. At the same time, it feels a little unusual to me that a full year of like exposure therapy would not have made a dent in this conditioned response.
Oh, I can believe it.
Huh.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen and known a lot of people who grew up in similar environments, some of whom are straight, some of whom are queer, and a lot of people can shed it quickly, and for a lot of other people, it's like taffy in your veins. It just sticks to every single crevice of like your interior self, and it takes a really long time to scrub out. I mean, I don't think this is usual. Like, I don't think this is common for people who were raised in really conservative environments and then later break out of it. But I get that that there would be instances where there is still an instinctive reaction even after knowing a lot of people for a long time.
Mm. And so do you have any advice for overcoming that?
Yeah. And I think your goal should be to overcome that, because you're going to see a lot of people in various relationships in your hopefully long life. And some of them are going to, you know, produce that feeling in you. And I think you would like to not be distracted, much in the same way that any sort of intrusive or compulsive thoughts that prevent us from, you know, functioning, from seeing other people as people, from recognizing the like loveliness of other people's relationships. I think that's really important. And it's like, again, it seems like you like Abigail and Betty's relationship. It's not like you feel like it's wrong that they're in a relationship together. It's just something physical and visceral in you when you see them like touching as a couple does. And I actually haven't recommended therapy for anyone yet today. So I'm going to go ahead and do this with like no sense of it's totally fine. I know I recommend therapy probably too much, but I think like cognitive behavioral therapy would be really useful. It's kind of like a short-term therapy that addresses unwanted or unhelpful habits, or any sort of therapy that's geared towards managing obsessive or compulsive thoughts. Often that's geared towards people who have been diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder, which I don't believe that this is the same thing, but you might find certain techniques that are useful for those people are also useful for you. So I would say find an LGBT positive therapist, and somebody who specializes in breaking habits, addressing intrusive and unwanted thoughts, and really focus on this for like a sustained period of time. Like go more than once a week. Hopefully you can find one that like your insurance can help cover, and really, really try to address what's going on there. I think that this is worth spending a significant amount of time and attention on, because you can get rid of this. This is not something that has to follow you around for the rest of your life, especially given that you already have the desire to not be this way, to not feel this way. Like you are not getting anything out of this feeling. You don't find it helpful. You don't want to go there.
Yeah, she's strongly motivated to change. Imagine how unpleasant your evenings would be if you're hanging out with your friends and they're holding hands and you have to suppress an involuntary reaction of disgust. That
it would be like
sounds
if every
like a
time,
horrible way to live.
Right. Like it would be like if you worked in restaurants and every time you saw a tomato, you just felt like disgusted. It would be a real hindrance to your ability to like be a person in the world. Like
exactly.
There are a lot of tomatoes in restaurants and it's just not useful. So I think, yeah, you've got the high motivation to tackle it. You're also really aware that this is not based in reality, that there's no part of you that believes that it's like the morally right thing to do to feel disgusted. And so I think you are going to be able to, if you really focus on this, break this cycle in the same way that somebody with compulsive nail biting would be able to get help, which is not to say it will go away immediately overnight and never come back. But you'll at least be able to like hang out with your roommate and her girlfriend and not periodically have this little like homophobic pinging in the back of your head that's like, this is upsetting, this is upsetting, this is upsetting.
Yep.
Yeah. Man, that's a good luck to this letter writer. I hope you write us back in a year and let us know if it's gotten any better, and what that process has looked like for you. I would love to get an update on this one.
I find myself feeling super sympathetic to all these letter writers. Do you have that every time? Like, are you like, oh God, I just want this to go okay for all of you?
Yes, especially in the podcast, because there's something about reading their letters out loud that makes me feel as if I am identifying with them even more than just reading a letter does. And even the ones where, you know, because sometimes I'll get a letter where it feels really clear to me the letter writer is the problem and needs to be informed of this. Even then, I will often feel a degree of sympathy for where they are coming from.
You hope they figure it out.
Yeah. No, I don't want them to be in the kind of pain that they're in. And especially today's batch, I think we've got a lot of like pretty well-meaning people. Gabriel, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. So much fun.
This was it. I feel ready to parent and be parented right now.
I look forward to returning to my own experience of parenting and being parented.
Oh, friends, that was one of the most draining episodes I've done in recent memory. I think I need to go lie down with a cold compress. But before I go, I want to remind you all something about herpes, which is, I get a fair amount of questions in the column about herpes, which is great, because I think we should all be learning more about herpes. But I recently got a letter that illustrated a common misconception that seems to pop up a lot in this column, which is that people really don't seem to understand what herpes is, which is one of the most common STIs it's possible to have. Something that roughly 1 in 6 Americans between the ages of like 15 and 50 have. Something that, while not curable, is very treatable. And with medication and protected sex and not having sexual contact when one is going through an outbreak, many people, by the way, with herpes do not have many outbreaks. Some have none, whatever. But I think this public perception is that herpes is like this really huge deal. And if you get it, that's shocking and upsetting. And, you know, if you someone knew you had herpes, that would just be the end. And that's really not the case. But I got a letter from someone who was convinced their partner was cheating on them and went through their phone and asked them, and they couldn't find any evidence and the person wouldn't admit it. So finally, they faked having herpes. And said, I just got back from, you know, the clinic and I've been tested and I have herpes and it must be because you cheated on me. And they finally got their partner to break down and confess, which is its own separate issue. But I just want to say, if you're going to fake having some sort of sexually transmitted infection, don't pick one that is incredibly common and that you could have easily contracted before you met your partner and simply not noticed for a really long time. Like, don't fake sexually transmitted infections at all. Maybe that should be the clearest point, but if you're going to, don't make it herpes, because that's just not going to help you make a strong case. But really, don't lie about your medical records in order to force your partners to tell the truth. And also, you know, go learn a little bit more about herpes. With that, I wish you all a safe, happy, and healthy next week, and I'll see you guys back here in a couple of days. Bye for now. Thanks for listening to Dear Prudence. Our producer is Audrey Dilling. Our theme music was composed by Robin Hilton. Steve Lichtai is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts, and Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of Panoply. Remember, you can always hear more Prudence by joining Slate Plus. Go to slate.com/plus to sign up. If you like this show, please go to iTunes and write us a review. It's a positive thing that you can do in a world full of wind and ghosts. If you want to hear me answer your question, call and leave a message at 401-371-DEAR, that's 3327, and you might hear your answer on an episode of the show. You don't have to use your real name or location, and at your request, we can even alter the sound of your voice. Keep it short, 30 seconds, a minute, tops.
What kind of ship is that?
It's a whaling ship, Doctor.